All right, guys, before we begin, is anybody here about to have a baby?
Not that I know.
Okay. Rules you out, Andrew. Effie?
I haven't been told, probably not.
I could be. Oh.
John?
Definitely not.
Right, so we're not going to be delayed by another week or so and then have lots of...
No, I don't think so. I think we're back on track.
Excellent. With that news, we can begin Season 3, Episode 19 of the Tux Radar podcast. I'm Mike Saunders.
I'm Jonathan Roberts.
I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Efrain Hernandez.
Wonderful. And in this episode, we'll be talking about Ubuntu's app developer site. We've got our discoveries of the week, our new section, Rants and Raves, don't miss that, Speak Your Brains, and of course, the Open Ballot. After you've listened to this podcast and you realise how wonderful it is, please subscribe to Linux Format Magazine to get loads more from us. We've got a great offer going, up to 50% off a subscription at tinyurl.com/LXFoffer. So let's get straight into the news then. And Canonical has launched the Ubuntu app developer site. This is developer.ubuntu.com. And it's very reminiscent of like Apple's site to get people into the App Store.
Lots of Canonical's strategy seems to be very reminiscent of Apple's strategy. I don't know if we can legally say that, but...
Nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with it at all. And
it's very successful, isn't it? Apple's strategy.
Yeah, I mean, I did take a look at it, and you know, it says no subscription, no costs. You know, just dive in to the development.
Because you have to pay £100 to be an Apple developer.
Something like that. Yes. You need some license. Yeah. You can develop apps, but if you want to publish it on the App Store, then you have to pay.
Yeah.
Wow. It's another world. It's a completely different world.
It is.
And it's a world that's not as good as our world.
No, it isn't. And it's quite nice. I mean, it's quite a nice idea that they're pushing Ubuntu as a platform in the same way that iOS might be.
Yeah, well, they have an example of how to get started quickly using Qwikly, the development framework, which I don't know if anybody...
Is that PyGDK? No.
It is Python.
It is Python.
Yeah.
It is Python. I don't know about... presumably PyGDK.
Or PyQt.
And right? And Qwikly is just some kind of... It does all the boilerplate stuff for you. And
yeah. But I think it's a good idea. If you've got a great idea for an application and you want to make it run on Linux, then instead of, you know, thinking, right, there are 12 million distros and five desktop environments, where do I start with all this? Well, go there and think, well, I'm going to target the biggest Linux distribution.
Yeah.
This is what I need to do, X, Y, and Z, in order to get it published on the Ubuntu Software Center.
Is it Ubuntu? I'm sorry, I didn't look, but I mean, are the guidelines, are the video tutorials Ubuntu specific? Are they helping you to create applications that tie themselves to Unity?
I don't.
It does talk about some of the Unity APIs,
right?
So for for Windicators, they never did that, did they? But
no,
their new indicator panel systems and all of that. So there are specific API features targeted at that on the website.
Yeah.
I don't suppose that's such a bad thing.
No, I think it's fine. There's nothing stopping you from trying to release software for a million other distros. But that's such hard work.
It shouldn't be. It did annoy me that I'm really interested in the elementary project, and I went to build some of their stuff. And apparently they've been removing these dependencies, so maybe I should try again. But I went to build it on Arch, and I was really disappointed to find that I then had to go and track down all these extra Canonical-only dependencies and build those as well. Like, why couldn't they just build it out of GTK and... You know, just keep it standard.
Yeah, but maybe that weren't the features they required there.
I don't know. They've made it optional, so they can't have been that core to it. So I don't want to see that kind of mistake replicated across other projects.
So are these applications, are the applications going to be, are they going to have a price tag as well? Or are they going to be free for Ubuntu?
You can charge them.
You can charge a minimum of £2.99, I think, I read, or $2.99. So you can put commercial applications on there. You send them a .deb, and it's supposed to, I think, extract into /opt. So it's supposed to be self-contained, which is fantastic news. But you can also put free software on there as well. But there is actually, unlike the Android market, there seems to be a review process. So it might stop a million, you know.
I don't think that's a bad thing, actually. I think
the review process. I think it's a great thing.
We've got lots of places to get stuff for free, and you know, and as long as Ubuntu keeps making those repositories available, there's no negative to it.
Yeah.
It's nice to have a review process.
I think, you know, as long as it just cuts out a tiny amount of stuff. I mean, the Android market's great in its freedom, but every single person who gets started with programming on Android releases their app to great fanfare, you know, MyPaint 1.0, which draws lines and stuff like that, and it does absolutely nothing. And the market is flooded with this baby first step software.
Well, it links to something, actually, that I think it was Miguel de Casa. He said that he believed that, I think it was him, I'd have to check, but he said that he believes that the main reason Linux adoption isn't growing is, in fact, going backwards, is the fact that there aren't any, there's only kind of 10 killer apps you can think of, and there aren't any more.
It was Miguel de Casa.
Yeah, it was Miguel.
And, yeah, and so if there can be anything done to create the same kind of environment as now currently exists in Android and on iOS for, you know, this fantastic playground for apps and creativity, then it can only be a good thing.
Yeah, Miguel blamed the fact that the APIs are shifting around a lot on Linux, and there's so many of them.
Something we've talked about, exactly for that reason.
Specifically, I think he was saying as well that we get one technology and it's really great and we have all tools in place, but then we get bored and we go on and we create the next new big technology.
Yeah.
And so Linux is always a platform that has amazing, you know, potential and amazing planning behind it, but no one ever builds any apps on it because everyone's always interested in writing the next big bit of plumbing.
Yeah. If we just said, right, this is the way it's going to be for 3 years and then we'll have another huge release, that'd be cool. That'd be a stable platform.
Yeah.
Maybe Ubuntu's developer site will encourage this. We'll say, build for this platform and we'll keep your app running for a while. We won't just throw everything out in 6 months' time.
What's interesting, though, on that app developer site, there's a, I'm pretty sure it was on there, there was a graphic showing the Linux app development ecosystem and kind of all the things that you build upon. So you got the kernel at the bottom and it goes, just the number of squares that were in that diagram, or the number of different possible routes you could go, and, you know, Qt, GTK, Thala, Python, C++.
Choice
is good.
It must be quite daunting for someone wanting to target Linux, and they might look and think, this is so complicated, I'll just keep, you know, I'll disregard that market.
The mad thing is like developing for the iPhone or for Android, you're using Java or Objective-C. Those are not easy languages to learn. But then you come to Linux and you can develop in Python if you want, or, you know, it's a simple language and the PyGTK bindings are really good. Why can't you do it?
Yeah.
It's much easier. It should be much easier.
Yeah, yeah. Let's make Python the official language of Linux.
Yes. New campaign. Meanwhile, there's another Linux mobile operating system, everybody. It's called Tizen, and this is born from Mego, which was born from Mimo, which was born from Moblin, wasn't it?
Begats.
Tizen. Tizen.org.
I did have a quick look at the website, and I couldn't get any kind of reasonable information out of it.
Not even with all the buzzwords.
No, that was the problem.
Did you see that Nokia are apparently looking at another version of Linux?
Yeah.
Why?
For feature phones, was it?
Yeah, for the cheapo end of their phones. So they're going to have Windows 7 and Linux running on different brands of phones.
Because the idea was that Windows 7 would scale down to the future phones, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And they've obviously realised it can't. It's something we could have told them.
It's a burning platform. Oh, hang on.
So, yeah, I don't really understand how, like, Moblin didn't really go anywhere. Mimo didn't really go anywhere. Mego didn't really go anywhere. Oh, and now let's rename it to Tizen, and this will change the world.
It does look like, I mean, I think there was rumours this past week that Intel was going to pull out of the Mego project, which is going to be the last major backer of Mego. So maybe this is what's prompted the move. Maybe somebody's thought, well, Mego is still good, and it is actually still good.
It looks a lot of effort has gone into it. Yeah. I would love to have had a phone with that on.
Yeah. But so, yes, so they still need someone to champion the Mego cause, and maybe somebody's thought, this is what it should be. No.
But apparently Samsung are involved with it, as are Intel.
Samsung, yeah.
And the Linux Foundation. So, okay, Intel and Linux Foundation is the same as was involved with Mego, but...
But they talk about
Samsung is new.
Tablets and smartphones. What reason is there to use whatever it's called today, Tizen, over Android?
Yeah, there's presumably no reason.
Yeah, I think you've got more freedom to make changes to the core code in Tizen. But, you know, Android is successful, it's well-tested, it's got a big app market.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at what Amazon can do with Android, with their new tablet, basically you can do anything you want. You don't. It doesn't have to be Android at all.
Because they basically forked it.
Yeah. And so why would you choose another platform? You know, I think platforms have to survive on their advantages. And the trouble with MeeGo is that it's never been out in the wild to actually go through a few kind of generations of improvement.
And, you know, Google have thrown so much money and time at Android to make it optimized for low-powered, small devices to make it fast and power-efficient.
Yeah.
But to not use that, you'd be insane.
It's now time for all of our favourite... No, it's my... it's one of another session. Discovery of the fortnight, which is kind of closer to 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks.
Yes.
We had thought this podcast would be on Monday or Tuesday, but it's just not worked out.
We must have loads of great discoveries now after 3 weeks.
You'd have thought so, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
I'd actually been writing down discoveries over the last few weeks of stuff that I wanted to share, and then I lost a piece of paper
and wasn't it on.
So like the dog ate my homework.
So we won't start with you then.
Okay.
Does anyone want to go? No, do you want to go first?
I have one which is related to what we were just talking about.
Yeah.
This morning I found out, I was reading Hacker News, which equally turns out is quite a cool website. I've only started reading it recently. But there was a link on it that an Amazon employee has leaked the pre-order figures for that Kindle Fire.
Yeah.
Apparently they've been getting something along the order of 2,000 orders and 2,000 an hour, did I say?
That's what you said earlier.
Yeah, 2,000 orders an hour for the Kindle Fire, which, if it carries on at that pace, is putting them on target for something like 2 million shipped devices on the first day alone.
That is brilliant.
It's really good.
I mean, Amazon have quietly done brilliantly with the Kindle. I mean, you see it all the time on the trains.
Yeah.
You know, these are non-geek people who are just finding it more convenient way of reading books. If they can capture some of that audience in a tablet.
I think whatever happens, the Kindle Fire will at least be a moderate success. It may not be a runaway 2 million devices a month iPad kind of success, but it is going to be a moderate success, I'm sure. Yeah. I'm pleased because I want there to be competition. And
desperately needs to be competition.
Yeah. I don't know if I really care about getting a tablet myself, but I do like there to be competition in the market, so...
Yeah.
I thought that's cool.
Anyone else?
I'll go next. Related to that. Mine was... it's quite related to what John was saying earlier on. I thought I've been neglecting my smartphone probably a bit, so I thought I'm going to go and look for some cool application, and I came across with Harry Potter Collection 7.1.1, which basically has an ebook application which has every single Harry Potter book on it.
Really?
How much is it? And is it official or is it
it was in the Android market. It was free.
Well, so it was probably pirated.
Yeah, that doesn't mean anything.
It was free.
Well, it's got a pretty picture of.
Even more copyright violation with a pretty picture.
It's got adverts at the bottom.
Really
cool. Adverts for Viagra.
Viagra is somewhere very angry right now.
JK, if you're listening.
There you go.
And you don't think you've got enough money.
It's amazing that you can just blatantly do that. I didn't realise.
It was on the Android market. So
it must be okay.
It must be okay. And what is that free?
Wow.
And every single person who reviewed it said, what a find. It should be a good one.
It's as if you don't have to take responsibility for anything you do because someone else on the internet has done it for
Can
you.
Can I have a look at
But if it is, if it is if it's on the Android internet, market, it should be fine, shouldn't it?
I must admit, I think exactly the same thing.
It's going to be...
Google does have some kind of editorial control over it.
Yeah, but only when it's reported. Anyone can publish. So if that was just published this morning, it might take a few hours. When did you get that app, Effie?
Well, I got it last night, but it's been reviewed by several people and it has something like 5 stars on the review. So it's got to be pretty popular.
Page turn button. How do I turn the page?
You have to get rid of that. Go back.
You actually have to visit the advert.
You have to visit the advert.
Turn the page.
That's terrible.
That cannot be a legit app.
I bet it would be taken down. Interesting journalistic find that you just downloaded for journalist news reasons.
Yeah.
Very investigative.
Because you already own all the copies of the books, right?
Well, I'll shortly be notifying JK Rowling.
Absolutely the first thing I'm going to do when we get up to the office. Because
well,
she needs the money.
That is ingenious, so putting the advert across the page turn button.
That is.
You have to tap the ad. Key.
Yeah.
That's a great discovery. I'm going to do that
but
with
not,
every
not
book.
But not all the time, though.
Not
all the time. It's only once.
Sometimes. Still.
It's only once.
Clever.
There you go. Well, that's a good find, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shall I go next? I haven't got anything remarkable because I've been kind of busy. But I will say, Pulse Audio 1.0 has been released.
No. I actually like Pulse Audio.
You said you're a bit unwell at the moment, so we'll let that go.
I think Pulse Audio itself as a system is very powerful. And I think exactly as I've said before, it just shouldn't present all of those options to the users.
It doesn't anymore. It just works.
Yeah, but if you install the Pulse Audio preferences panel, so you can choose all the things. Well, it is powerful. I mean, it solved a problem for me in that I use USB audio headphones on my Linux machine. And they're only partly supported, so volume only comes out. No, I couldn't control the volume at all. It was far too loud, so I couldn't wear them. But using Pulse Audio and its various syncs and sources, I could use Pulse Audio to change the volume.
I find just that Pulse Audio makes a lot of Linux audio things just work, whereas before you'd have to mess around with ALSA, you know.
But ALSA's still there.
ALSA's still there underneath it, but Pulse Audio makes it just work. I don't know how it does, but...
So it's a layer on top of loads of cruft to get it to
Pulse
work.
Pulse Audio is required with GNOME 3 and Arch. If you do a fresh Arch install with GNOME and Pulse Audio gets installed, you don't have to mess around with ALSA mix or anything like that. You just install GNOME 3 and your sound works as well. And
yeah, but
you plug in USB headphone, it handles all of that really well. I actually quite like Pulse Audio.
If it's like spit shine on top of a load of poo, though, I mean, it's like a layer to cover up all the cruft underneath. Perhaps it'd be simpler if there was just one thing.
In my opinion, it works. And if it is low latency, as I understand it.
If everyone could agree to just use Pulse Audio, you know, and sort out these problems, then that would be fine. But the problem is that you can never predict what's going to happen.
No, because there will be something new and cool in 2 years' time.
Well, 1.0 uses the dbus control protocol, which is cool. So apps could configure stuff. Source output volumes. Now, this is the second feature for 1.0, and that's exactly what's wrong with Pulse Audio. What are source output volumes? They're actually capture streams for each application. So when you're recording voice into something like Skype, you can control the input volume that's going to Skype, not the input on your audio unit. That's something else. And there's decent pass-through support. Connected to that, ARDA 2.8.12 has been released, and it's the first release for 18 months because they're working on 3.
Yeah.
But it works with Pulse Audio, and what's nice about the new version of Pulse Audio
The new ARDA works with Pulse Audio.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
And there's Linux binaries that are statically linked, so they should just run. And the nice thing about the latest Pulse Audio is that if Jack is running, it'll automatically connect to Jack. So as long as you've got Jack installed, you install Pulse Audio and then grab the binaries of ARDA, then everything should just work. And getting ARDA to work is usually difficult.
So that's a big improvement.
It could be. I haven't tried it. But it could be. I mean, just talking about it sounds very complicated.
But talking about it sounds like it just works again. It's another example of Pulse Audio just working.
Can I just say
that I really like the fact that when you have this sort of audio mixing music discoveries, your face really lights up.
Yeah.
You have the biggest smile I've ever seen in my life.
I'm really not that excited by Pulse Audio. But the next one is that, this isn't Linux related at all, but I've got a Korg Poly 6 synth, which I've had for 20 years, and it was broken because battery acid had spilt all over the CPU board. And some really brilliant people online reverse engineered the CPU board and created brand new PCB designs that means you can take all the broken chips off it and put them back on this new PCB and they're fixed. And also the guys that did it, there's a guy called Andrew Drury and the guy Jed Jorgensen, they'll do it. Well, Andrew Drury will do it for cost. If you send in your old board, he'll put the new chips on. And it's a hell of a job. There must be like 100 chips.
Have you done that job yourself?
I haven't done it, no. I couldn't. I sent it to Andy Drury and he did it. And now I've got a working Poly 6 and it's awesome.
Cool.
It is really cool.
And it's just brilliant what people can do when there's you know, when people are interested in keeping old technology going. Yeah, that's it.
I think one of my discoveries segues neatly into the old technology and how awesome it is.
Cool.
Mu Linux.
Mu Linux?
Yes.
Well, MU.
I'm glad we did MU. That in unison.
Really, really teeny tiny.
Oh, micro Linux, like, yeah.
Mu.
The Greek letter.
The Greek letter, yes. Yeah. Not like a sort of bovine Linux or anything.
That's what I was going to say.
Installs onto 20 megabytes of disk space.
Really?
Yeah, and uses 4 meg of RAM to run.
And what do you get with that?
I don't know what you get, to be honest. I was just blinded by the numbers.
Well,
which I think is pretty impressive.
I used this about 8 years ago when it was on 2 floppy disks and included X and a file manager and some primitive window manager.
You want X and you just haven't got the space.
Well, I thought it was really cool at the time because everybody used to say X is bloated and X is, you know, unsuitable for really old hardware. But I always had fun getting X working on 486s and stuff.
Getting X working and then running X term.
Yeah. So basically, yeah.
And X
clock and X eyes. Yeah.
How many X clocks can we open?
But yeah, I remember Mu Linux. It's great to hear that it's still going, albeit it's upgraded a bit now to hard drives.
They've not really upgraded it all that much. It appears to have been dormant for the last 10 years or so, but it's still out there.
I've got to ask you something, though, unless this is top secret about something to do with a magazine, but the other day I saw you installing a North Korean Linux distribution. What's going on, Andrew?
I may mention it later in the podcast.
Okay. Why is that in open ballot?
other awesome discoveries include that one that Mike's just ruined, MU Linux. Oh, that's right. OpenOffice.org now runs really fast on my Mac now that IT have given it 8 gigs of RAM.
Cool. And just enough.
Can you install OpenOffice on our Office Macs?
Yeah, all you have to do is ask.
Oh, really?
It turns out.
Damn. All those years I've been converting stuff on my Linux box.
I know.
Yeah, we used to. We did trial running NeoOffice.
NeoOffice
as a company-wide kind of strategy.
Really?
Something, and it was rubbish.
We said it was great, but other magazines said it was
rubbish. But it was rubbish because we knew that there was a much, much better later version of OpenOffice available.
Well, NeoOffice 2 was out at the time. We went with NeoOffice 1.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's just a recipe for experiment to fail.
It's terrible, isn't it?
It's the kind of thing you do when you want something not to work out. You put out the old version.
That's true.
Yeah. It was a word count or a spell check, and it didn't have it, even though NeoOffice 2 did.
Yeah, I remember you're right. It was something like that.
It was pretty damn poor. Aren't
you just the master of English, aren't you?
Well, I am, but some people around this table aren't.
Oh, I live by this spell checker. I type words kind of approximately. I just hope autocorrect does its job.
Do you know, there's one or two words that I just can never spell, and autocorrect can't figure out what I mean. And I'm trying like 10 different spelling suggestions to get autocorrect to give me the right answer. Yeah. And this is how I got through my degree.
But seriously, kids, work hard in school because it is worth it.
Look after your teeth.
My other discovery was non-Linux related in any way at all. I found a copy of National Geographic magazine in Oxfam, and it had the cover line, Yugoslavia, a house divided. And it was all about all the internal strife in Yugoslavia, with like loads of really cool pictures and a really insightful essay. And I looked on the date and it was from 1990.
Wow. Ooh.
It was before the Civil War kicked off. It was when the Berlin Wall had only just come down. And it's so weird, really, really freaky, like time machine freaky to flick through this story and read the journalist going, oh, it could all go a bit wrong. Ooh.
Yeah, but there are lots of young people who that won't be recent memory for. I mean, it's still 22 years.
John? You're looking blank.
I know what the word Lavia means.
I vaguely remember the NATO bombing campaign.
Can you remember U2 performing from Sarajevo?
Sadly not.
Anyway, that was a discovery for old people.
That just leaves me. Right. Yeah, I have a really, really happy discovery. I was getting some software for the disk or messing around or something, and I came across the T editor, a text editor, TEA, all in capitals. It probably stands for something. But anyway, I thought I'd try it out. So I got this tarball and I extracted it, and there was just a single binary file. I thought, well, how's this going to work? That's it. And I ran it, and everything was there in the single binary. It included the manual, all the PIX maps for all the icons, and everything. It was all rolled into a single binary. There wasn't loads
of... So it's a graphical text editor.
A graphical, can't remember if it's GTK or QT text editor, with all these things that normally be scattered all over your file system, all these extra docs and resources and files, and it was just all in one single binary.
And you actually didn't install them on the system and you didn't realise?
Oh, I could have put a massive backdoor in, and just downloaded them all off the internet, but I was just really, really impressed that...
How have they done it?
I don't know. There must be... I don't know, but it's... Developers should do that. It makes life so much simpler. Put stuff into your executable.
Yeah.
So then you don't have to say, oh, well, extract this into var lib and user lib and have stuff scattered all over your file system, which is an incredibly dated concept. If you can, just bung it all together into an executable, because then you can put that wherever you want.
Why is it a dated concept? I'm intrigued about the concept itself and like why it started and why it's not good anymore.
Well, we used to have user local for stuff that would be installed on the local machine, and /user could be got off the network, for instance, and stuff like that. But
now that most people are using a personal computer rather than a network system at work.
But,
there are obviously there are problems when libraries get updated and nothing, I guess, if it does use Qt, for example, it's getting updated all the time and you can always take advantage of the new libs with other applications. But as it's statically linked, you can't.
Well, this isn't statically linked. It just has all the resources rolled into it. So it still uses the Qt on the system.
Oh, does it?
Yeah, but it just somehow has all its own stuff rolled into the binary.
Oh, right. I see what you mean.
Yeah, so they could statically link it as well. I know what you mean about the library issues, but I think dynamically link with some big obvious stuff like Qt and stuff. But if you're going to use libfoobar 0.03 then just put that in your own binary and just
the nice thing is that whatever tool they've used, it's probably easy to use. It's not like auto package. It would probably just generate. It'd be quite handy for the disk.
Yeah, it would.
It lets people try things out, and if they like it, then they can track down a deb or whatever it is they want.
Exactly. Yeah, it lets people try stuff without it spreading into 30 different directories on the hard drive.
You just delete it.
You just remove that thing. It's so simple. It's so beautiful and elegant. And
that does sound quite cool.
Yeah, that should be the future.
Is that a good application?
Yeah, it's all right. I just like the idea that I can get an app and run it, and then if I don't like it, I delete it. I don't have to think about package managers. I don't have to think about file databases. I don't have to think about all these resources.
Have you tried Windows? It sounds like you might like
Mac
it.
OS,
Windows is pretty crap in that respect as well with the registry. Mac OS is considerably simpler.
It's not in the it's not in the detail though, is it? I mean, building packages for OS X is quite complicated. And the pretend single files that are really folders full of stuff.
Is that what happens?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
That's how it acts.
Disk images, aren't they, that Mac OS uses?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're quite handy. They're good.
I've built one of those. That's dead simple. Yeah, I've done that before.
Well, I've done it, but it wasn't easy.
You just create a disk image and drop your...
Oh, the disk image, but the application itself is really a folder.
Oh, right.
With all of the resource.
Yeah, it is. But when you're using OS X, it behaves like a file.
When you're using it, you have no idea of all of this.
Yeah, so it's simple for the user, that's the thing. But
often when I've wanted to add command line arguments to an application, and you have to go into the folder on the command line, into the resources, into Mac OS, into bin, where hides the small binary. That's insane.
Well, yeah, but... It makes it, generally life's easier for the end user. So
for the end user.
Yeah, and you just put an app wherever you want.
So. Yeah, I was thinking in terms of building those kind of things. It's not like you can, in Qt actually, you can just create an application. I know the process isn't easy.
It's the halfway point now, and still to come, our brand new section, which John's going to introduce, along with Speak Your Brains and the Open Ballot.
Okay, so now it's time for our new section, Rants and Raves.
That's a great name for a section.
It is pretty cool. Who came up with that, Mike?
Oh, I don't know. Some schmo.
So the general idea is that we fail at Discovery of... not even Discovery of the Week.
We fail at that too.
We just fail. The idea is that one of us is going to talk about something in Linux that we love and something that we hate.
That sounds cool. So what? Should we time it to a minute then?
Yeah, let's keep it to a minute and we can have this done in 2 minutes. See how sharp my maths is.
All right then. So let's have a minute of ranting, and then let's have a minute of raving. Have you just installed GNOME 3.2 and you're not too happy with
it? I have, and I am not happy. All right with then. But I don't know if I can rant for a whole minute, but I'll try.
You can try.
Once you start, it's actually surprisingly easy. Yeah.
Okay.
I've done it for 27 minutes.
Oh. All right. Shall I begin the countdown? Yeah. 3, 2, 1, go.
Okay, so I've just installed GNOME 3.2 on Arch, so I don't know how much of my complaints are with GNOME 3.2 or the fact that I've upgraded and Arch doesn't install all the new dependencies properly and stuff. Maybe I should try a fresh install. But my biggest annoyance is that the new login screen is terrible. And it sounds like a small thing, but you know when you log on, your login screen comes up, you hit enter, then you type your password. You don't have to use the mouse to select your user. Have to use your mouse.
That's rubbish.
How bad is that?
That is punt.
Not also, all of the text is too big. Again, this sounds stupid, but it looks ugly. Like, they've done it to make it look shell style. It's nice and black and shiny and sleek. But the text is like 10 foot high, and you feel like you're an old man trying to read a newspaper. I can't see it, you know? So that's very annoying. And then you get into the actual system itself. And here again, oh, has that almost been a minute already?
So the login screen is terrible.
Finish.
Excellent.
Right.
I gotta say, install
another login screen, folks.
Don't use GNOME 3.2.
I can't stand that login screen. And
no, it's too late. Also, you had your chance.
Please, there's more I want to say. There's more I want to say.
We can have part two in the next podcast. Oh, I'm not sure I'll be able to finish. Fill a full minute, said John.
You're just getting warmed up.
Maybe you could put your own recording on the site.
Just the me complaining. I'm going to put a video on the site to show you my complaints.
Go on, have a quick mention of the other thing you were going to say, though. Just
there's this new documents application, which looks really good, but it doesn't seem to index all of my Google Docs, although it is cool that it indexes any of my Google Docs. But also, I can't get Tracker to index any of my local documents, and they just don't show up. So I have 6 Google Docs and no local documents. So it looks cool, but it completely failed. I'm disappointed.
Okay, well, like I say, maybe you could try a fresh install, because as intrigued as I am by the rolling release mechanism, presumably it does leave some cruft around from previous releases.
Things like fonts are stuff that gets screwed up on wayward DPI settings somewhere.
A fresh, like, dry Fedora a 19 beta or whatever it's up to at the moment.
16 beta did just come out today.
Right, okay. Maybe if that has it then. Cool. Now, we need somebody to counterbalance that with a rave, to talk for a minute about something really cool in Linux.
Yeah, I found some awesomeness.
Oh, Andrea's smiling and happy.
Andrea may well be smiling and happy, but she's not here.
That was a verbal oddity. Okay. You've got 1 minute, starting from now.
You may well remember the reports of Red Star OS, the North Korean Linux distribution developed exclusively for North Korea.
The Great Republic.
By North Koreans.
And I tried it out yesterday. Well, I installed it yesterday. And it's, you know, the rave is that it installed in about 8 minutes flat.
That's because of the dear leader.
It's absolutely amazing. Like, those developers were obviously listening to loads of Elvis and drinking loads of brandy, because it installs so quickly. And when I think back to when I first tried to install Mandriva in, I don't know, 2005, 2006, it was an absolute pain, and it didn't even come up with a graphical, like, because it couldn't detect my screen, and rather than come up with a sensible default resolution, it completely failed to come up with any sort of graphics at all. But the North Koreans, bless them, they've got this one right.
Is that because of the Juche idea, or whatever they call it?
The Juche idea, I don't know. You can read about it in a forthcoming Linux forum.
Nice one, Andrew.
That was much better than mine.
So are you using this Red Star Linux permanently now? Is it your distro of choice?
No.
Did you have to learn Korean to use it?
Well, you don't really have to learn Korean, because everything's sort of where it is, but I would have to learn KDE.
Oh, that's far harder.
Which is just too much of a mental leap. And I mean, I genuinely mean this, because I tried using GNU Linux, the extra Majoran Linux thing, and as Effie will attest, I don't speak any Spanish. But because everything's more or less where it is in a standard GNOME desktop, you can get by, and you can, you know, everything makes sense, and everything's sort of where it should be in my brain. But because KDE is wrong, it doesn't matter what language it's in. I just can't get my head around it. Even when it's in English, I just can't work out KDE.
Do you get pictures of the dear leader in any application that you use?
It's a really cool logo. It's like this red sort of Korean symbol. It looks a little bit like a dragon on a blue background. It looks cool.
Does it set up its own DNSs and things like that?
I don't know. I did a Google search for democracy, you know, it didn't come up with anything. But That may have been because I skipped past the network configuration thing, which was all in Korean, so I don't know.
Is that actually true?
It's actually true.
Awesome. Let's move on to Speak Your Brains, and we've got a couple of emails from listeners this episode, and we're going to start off with Harvey Kelly, who says, with Linus Torvalds complaining that KDE4 was rubbish and didn't work the way he wanted, so he switched to GNOME, then GNOME 3 not running as he liked, so he switched to XFCE4, does he suffer from that syndrome where a computer user learns one way to do something and can't switch to another, possibly faster or quicker way of achieving the same thing? I can't remember what it's called, but we tend to think that it's a Windows-specific illness. Obviously, he suffers from a high uber-geek genius version of it, but still. By the way, if you mention in your podcast that Meg Penny is Scotland's Audrey Horne, then you'll be my all-time hero. That's cool. I thought I was everyone's all-time hero anyway, but... So, yeah, Linus Torvalds, jumping around between desktops.
Yeah, I think, man, it is a good point, and maybe he's right, but my guess is that Linus Torvalds just doesn't like things changing. You know, he got used to a certain way of working, and he just doesn't want to tolerate somebody's new idea of what the desktop should be, and the same that happened for KDE and that's happened for GNOME, you know, and it doesn't happen for XFCE, not all that much.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised he doesn't use something very minimal, you know, just FEWM or something with his own custom config.
Before this podcast goes out, could we do a quick legal check to see that we've not, you know, terribly slandered Audrey Horne?
Who is Audrey Horne?
Well, I don't know.
I googled
up. She could be an enormous serial killer, for example.
Oh yeah, that's true.
And saying that Meg Penny is Scotland's Audrey Horne would be slandering Meg Penny.
You're right. Yeah, that's true. I googled up both names and found nothing. So.
Oh well, if Google says nothing, then
yeah,
there is nothing.
I don't think there's anything to speak. All right, but this isn't our fault. That's what Harvey Kelly said. So if anybody, all I am is a carrier. I am just a common carrier.
You're like YouTube.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the Android App Store.
Yeah.
Have you been on that legal training course where was it Dominic Diamond? Yeah.
I had to do that when I joined.
Yeah.
So, I'm not sure that's a defence.
Well, it's my defence, so, you know, that will work. Meanwhile, Leonard Brown emailed me to say, I am happy to report that I am up to Firefox 9.0 Alpha 1, and I no longer have any... And I no longer have any compatibility issues with Firefox. The discovery of my week is add-on compatibility...
It's 'cause he's in 2013.
The discovery of my week is add-on compatibility reporter. It is itself an add-on, but once you install it, you can install and run any other add-on, even those that report it as incompatible. Once installed, I recommend disabling add-on compatibility checking. Enabling add-on compatibility checking will disable your add-ons that are found to be incompatible. You can instead try the add-ons yourself and file a report to Mozilla on the status of the add-on. I found that all my add-ons that were previously listed as incompatible do in fact work, so I've reported them as working properly.
My brain hurts.
Oh my god.
This seems to be the Mozilla way of fixing things. Instead of fixing it, make another add-on to try and fix other add-ons.
Recursive add-ons, wasn't it?
Yeah. That really hurts my head.
Oh yeah, that was the last time my brain hurt this much, was learning about recursion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would you be able to use that word today?
Add-on. I'll have to say extension. I mean, yeah, that's quite, you know, they're quite famous, the problems with add-on compatibility in Firefox's rapid release schedule. I was reading the Slashdot discussion the other day about the newest Firefox release, and someone posted again that it had broken some of their add-ons, and I just don't think they've got a clue anymore. So stability is very, very important to people, and the fact that Firefox is still breaking people's add-ons at this stage is just completely unacceptable.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seems they're losing market share and people are going to Chrome where stuff works. So.
I don't think they're actually losing market share. I think that Chrome is gaining it faster than Firefox from IE. I think Firefox is still gaining month on month.
No, I thought I saw it had a slight drop, but...
Yeah, I'm sure I saw it.
Oh, really?
Too.
I thought I read today that a post... Oh, I don't know.
Well, it depends which market you're looking at, stuff like that. If it's Europe versus USA versus the world and stuff. But still looking at the discussions on Slashdot and things with the new releases, people are very disappointed with the breakage and constant jumbling around. It's not, you know, if we were on version 0.8 here, it's fair enough for them to be breaking stuff. But please, people, stability, compatibility. Anyway, thanks Harvey Kelly, who might get sued, and thanks Leonard Brown. If anybody else wants to have their potentially litigious comments read out on the podcast, then email me mike.saunders@futurenet.com with the subject line "Speak Your Brains."
Open ballot!
Hooray!
So, open ballots. We asked, actually a bit of context really, Microsoft is talking about pushing this UEFI secure boot system on as part of Windows 8. So, for equipment manufacturers to have their PCs, laptops, etc., certified ready for Windows 8, which is presumably quite a big selling point for them, they'll have to enable this feature called UEFI Secure Boot, which means that your computer can only boot a bootloader that has been officially approved either by Microsoft or by the manufacturer. By the manufacturer, I think, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
It's got to be signed, basically. It's all encryption.
There's got to be some secure key, and it's got to be approved. So Microsoft is saying that this will make your computer safer, because it means that people can't come along and sneak into your office in the middle of the night and install an operating system that has viruses on it.
Or Red Star Linux.
Or Red Star OS.
Red Star OS.
Yeah. Does this also stop like live CDs booting and people, you know, taking out your Windows password hashes and...
Well, presumably, yeah. I think there are some legitimate security arguments.
There are lots of viruses that do exploit that, exactly. Right. You know,
yeah.
When the boot routine is signed and can be verified, you know, right down to the BIOS, it will make it secure.
Lots of viruses? Lots of Linux viruses?
No. Windows viruses.
Oh, okay.
I mean, what I'm saying is that I can see why Microsoft wants to do it, and it's not actually a bad technical idea.
Technically, but they may also be using it to try and make it difficult for people.
They are. Mm. And I think that is an awful problem and kind of negates any advantage for Windows users.
Yeah, this will make it difficult for people to run Linux on their machines, because they will need a signed bootloader,
they'd need to leave a door open which negates all the effect of the signatures.
Yeah, and there's a problem with having all these encryption keys and the GPL as well, isn't there?
So it's bad.
So just to get it right, so if you buy a new laptop that has been certified by Microsoft,
you can't install
it. You can install it, you cannot use it.
Not necessarily quickly anyway. There might be ways around it, but it gets complicated, and then that means instead of putting a disc on our magazine saying, hey, try Linux today, we have to put in loads of complicated instructions about messing around with your UEFI prompt, stuff like that. If it's more hassle to install Linux, then it's going to put people off trying it.
And you can imagine that, you know, turning off that kind of security in the UEFI prompt is going to come with all kinds of warnings. You are voiding your warranty.
Yes.
You know, you won't get supported updates to Windows. Windows might even complain and say, look, we can't verify your system, you're screwed.
But then Microsoft has to make sure that the potential buyer of this hardware knows what he is or she is.
No, they don't.
No.
They have to. Because you have the right to do whatever you want to break if you want.
No, but this is it's the same as Apple hardware, isn't it? Nobody actually complains you can't install anything else on Apple hardware. And that's what Microsoft is probably trying to do. It's trying to control the ecosystem, make it more homogenous. And also, as we've just seen, it's actually it's a difficult concept to grasp, especially for the vast majority of people who just buy PCs and laptops. Why do they need to know what a bootloader is or whether something's verified?
If it's more secure for them, way.
The answer is that they won't be able to boot Linux and install it.
Well, that's a terrible thing for Linux.
It's a terrible thing for Linux.
Simple as that.
It is.
But people aren't going to be interested, sadly, in PC world if there's a big star next to the computer saying, warning, does not let you install Linux. You know, people aren't going to be that bothered. This is a problem for existing Linux users and trying to encourage people to run Linux. But most people won't care.
So with that context, we move on to the question, will the necessity of fiddling with the UEFI options put people off trying Linux?
sorry. Yeah, can we go home?
Well, I think really it's incumbent on us to read out some pertinent quotes and comments. Hyauj.
Yay! Who made a Rubik's Cube for us?
Says, Microsoft knows exactly what it's doing. It can keep us out and make it look like they're doing the world a favour in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Refugee from Windows says, MS are of course trying to find ways to keep their market share. No doubt the discount on Windows 8 would vanish if the OEMs didn't lock their hardware. So Microsoft isn't explicitly going to force anybody to use this technology, but those who don't, oof, they'll be held to pay. Ray Woods says, to my mind, in Microsoft's shoes, I would do the same. It may be anti-competitive, but we are doing it in the name of security. I just hope the legal eagles spot this ruse and jump up and down on them with a heavy legal stick and bludgeon them to pulp. That's a fair point. I think possibly the European Commission or the European Monetary Union or whatever it's called nowadays may have something to say about this.
I have a question about this. Doesn't Chrome OS and Chromebooks do this already?
That's true. Yeah.
But you can still install Linux on the original Chrome notebook.
I don't know the Chrome. Do they have a normal BIOS or do they use an AFI?
I don't know, but I know it was the operating system was signed.
Yeah.
And Verify boot.
But
so
that's slightly different in that. They can check the validity of the OS once it's booted up against whatever that is online, rather
right.
than actually not allowing the system to boot if the keys aren't right.
Right, okay, so
I guess that's what the Chrome netbook does.
So, but then that's just as secure as what Microsoft's trying to do.
Yes,
so there's
yeah,
no reason
yeah,
Microsoft couldn't
yeah.
take that alternative route.
And I think that's the main point. If it's no more secure than doing exactly that,
yeah.
which is a more sensible option.
Because it keeps you allowed to do what you want with your computer still.
Yeah, because there are other reasons as well. People should want the freedom to be able to install an older version of Windows if
yeah.
they want to.
I think a lot of people want to do that. I mean, if you look at, I've said before, but if you look at how many people stuck around with Windows XP, people don't like to change that often. I don't think...
Although, I don't know, I think maybe partly that was because Windows Vista was terrible.
Yeah, arguably so, but, you know, people were still willing to stick with an operating system that was much, much,
yeah.
much older. Windows 7... has its flaws, and I don't particularly like it, but it seems to be good enough for a lot of people. So, you know, I think a lot of people just want to stick with that and not be interested in all the gimmicks and stuff of the new one. And, you know, people have said that the BIOS was going to disappear years and years and years ago, and it's still there on most PCs, and it's a ridiculously ancient bit of code, 16-bit real mode, that I use in MicroS, so I love it, but it's very, very old, and it's still shipping on PCs today. So I think this is a problem we need to address and think about, but I don't think it's going to really kick in for another 5-10 years
but
or so.
EFI did solve the problem. It's just that Microsoft was supposed to jump to EFI bootloaders and BIOSes for Windows 7, and they never did.
Well, that's it, yeah, because I think, like you say, people are going to want to install older operating systems. You know, I don't think... It will happen, but it's going to take a long time. Our job is to get enough people using Linux so that there's a sufficient number of people who demand open computers. So let's have a really good 5 years of...
So we've got 5 years.
...to make an awesome, cohesive Linux desktop.
Mir the Gym makes an awesome point, which Charlie also agrees with later on. The hardware manufacturers will eventually put a stop to this one. Most tech repair shops use open source software to remove viruses and fix hardware glitches with a bootable flash drive. Let's hear it for Nopix.
Yeah.
Without said tools, a machine has to go back to the manufacturer for repair. So once Sony, HP or Samsung sees how much secure boot is costing them, it's done.
No, what will happen is that companies will create signed versions of Nopix or whatever, you know, commercially.
Yeah.
And then they'll sell them.
Actually,
sell
a potential opening
people.
In the market.
Yeah.
yeah.
For a signed Linux distro.
It'll just mean that your next door neighbour can't do it.
You won't be able to share it with.
Yeah, yeah.
Off topic, Hyauj says, Hyauj not verified, says, how does one get verified?
That's a secret. You get verified by sending Rubik's Cubes to our office.
Or beer.
Or beer. Please send us some beer, someone.
We're desperate.
Bruno says, as an aside, this might make a nice article for the magazine. What technologies are there out there that aspire to supersede the BIOS? How do they work and who is behind them? I know Core Boot was covered in LXF147, but what else is out there?
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
yeah, excellent idea. Thanks for that, Bruno. Fraxinus says, perhaps I am displaying my lack of technical knowledge here. However, if it's just the bootloader, is there any possibility that a major commercial player in the Linux software world, say Red Hat, creating the appropriate signed package and distributing it freely to all Linux users who want it? Surely it would be in their interest to do so.
No, that won't work.
Why won't it work?
Because that it will be tied against the key and the BIOS will be tied against the operating system. So it'll be for each specific installation on each machine. That's the only way that Microsoft will be able to securely ensure that the data is their data. So you simply won't be able to install Linux or anything else without turning that off. If you could install Linux freely, then you could access the Windows files and you could change things.
Okay.
I reckon.
Yeah,
I've not looked at the specification of it. But.
Yeah, that's how I understand it as well.
here's a... some rather avant-garde thinking. Penguin Dian Wu says that the Microsoft are in effect training the next generation of hackers. How long until they realise that raising the bar to do what you want to do drives people to investigate and learn about other options? Locked down Android phones have already gone a long way towards training the next generation of hackers. I now have a dozen semi-computer savvy relatives that understand what Linux, root and bootloaders all mean because friends or co-workers help them install Cyanogen mod on their phones. This will just take that one step further. Instead of only us multi-OS geeks understanding how to configure multi-boot, it will drive a whole new population to learn about how their PC loads an operating system. I disagree. Anybody else?
Yeah, I don't think it will suddenly reduce in a massive flurry of hackers, but by making it more difficult. But people are still... I see what he means, that people are still going to fight against it and learn more and just become better at it. It's like, you know, DVD encryption and stuff. People just will work out how to break it.
Honeypuck says more or less what merely Jim just said about could Red Hat produce their own version.
Thinking this through, I don't see technically why the data on the Windows partition can't be signed against the certificate in the UEFI so that it's only decrypted at boot time and only ensured to be valid at boot time. So that if you actually install another operating system alongside it, such as Linux, all that data is encrypted on the drive against the keys in the UEFI, so you can't get to it and it cannot be changed. What's wrong with that?
Whole drive encryption.
Yeah, or even just a partition with Windows on it, so that the data on that partition is untouchable.
Yeah,
so that you can still boot another OS.
There's dozens of ways of doing it, isn't there?
But
have to screw over.
That wouldn't be any less secure, would it?
But do you have to decrypt all data on the fly then as you're using it?
Well, that can be done.
Isn't that performance?
No, you'd be amazed if you run full disk encryption in Linux, which is available in all Linux distributions pretty much.
But also that's must be what it would do anyway.
Yeah.
Or even if you're like doing video editing and stuff like that, and every block of the disk, it's got to decrypt and encrypt.
Yeah, because if you think about it, it's just going through kind of a binary hash every time you're reading, writing data. It's actually nothing.
If it's simple, fast encryption, yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, but that's not simple. It doesn't have to be simple encryption. It's just the valid. That's just making sure you don't have to go through the number grinding part once you've got all the keys open.
Once you've got the keys, it's just hashed.
Yeah.
So, and also a lot of processors these days have acceleration built in for doing just that, for online banking and stuff. So
it can be done in real time.
Yeah, that would make more sense, because then it'd leave your PC a completely open machine to whatever you want to put on
it. So you can run a non-verified OS
and
then have the verified OS that's tied to the UEFI. And I think that Microsoft and whoever's developing UEFI actually do have a moral obligation to make sure that happens.
I think, like Andrew said, the European Commission will look unkindly on it if it stops new entrants into the market.
But that's communism.
If it was MS hardware, then maybe fair enough.
Yeah, but if it's on all hardware, then...
Okay, so protecting our computer rights and propping up the euro, good for them. the final mention must go to Aegis, who heads his comment with Microsoft fighting fire with gasoline. And that makes me think of David Bowie and Giorgio Moroder. So that's an awesome way to end it.
Okay, that's it. Podcast episode 19.
Yeah, it was a good one.
It was a good one, yeah. I think it went quite well. I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, I'd give it an 8.5 out of 10.
Yeah, I much preferred its previous one, but then we were under quite a lot of stress.
That's almost rubbish.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, we're really, really sorry about that.
So thanks for listening. Thanks everyone here for
coming down, joining in.
Thanks, Effie.
We'll probably see you.
I'm still reading
Harry Potter. can they remotely wipe those programs? Can Google delete that from your phone?
I don't know.
We'll soon find out.
I think they can.
They can remote wipe applications. So we'll soon
That's
see.
Terrible.
But I haven't even finished the first route, the first book.
You might have to buy the book then.
I'll bring it in and lend it to you. Is that legal?
Oh, I don't know.
Can you photocopy it for me?
Hang
on, I've got one more thing.
Yeah.
Cool. Oh.
It's really cool that a self-made woman is richer than the Queen. So don't rob from her.
You're saying the Queen isn't a self-made woman?
I really enjoyed the books. I really did.
Yeah.
He's got every single film on the DVD and Blu-ray.
By using her brain, she's become richer than the Queen. That's awesome.
Yeah.
No one is questioning that, Andrew. Don't take it personally.
I'm not taking it personally because I'm not J.K. Rowling or the Queen. Okay.
So you defend her.
Okay, before we all start fighting, I guess we'll see you all in 2 weeks. I think we'll do it on a Thursday again. Bye.
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 Bye. Bye.